and possibly want to learn more about it. I'll be speaking to you tonight from two perspectives. The first perspective will be from a historical perspective, and it will be concerning shape note singing, the things that I have learned through others' research and through others' documentation. This has taken me a lot of time to get things together because there's not one great source on this subject. There's little smidgens in a myriad of books and records and this sort of thing. So I'm sharing with you what I found along those lines. I'm also going to speak to you from the perspective of having grown up in this tradition and done it for five generations in my family, and I've done it since I was a child. And that is the perspective I know best, but it's not a perspective that can be found in a book. So I'm sharing with you what I feel and what I've learned. So that'll be two ways of looking at it tonight. I want to start out with a history, and it's going to be a painless history on this. We'll go very briefly through it. Well, not too briefly that you'll get lost, but I don't want to spend a lot of time on any one particular point tonight. During the week, we will get in more depth to some of these topics. This is a chronological history of shape note singing, and we're going to take it back to the 1600s. That's a long time ago. Some historians have traced the roots of shape note singing back to Lancashire, England, to a system called the Lancashire Solfa System. And I'd like to read to you Oxford's Musical Dictionary's definition, since they say it best. Lancashire Solfa, a modern name for a system of sight singing, more properly called Old English Solfa, since it was universally used in England from at least the early 17th century. It is a method of psalmization applied to the normal staff notation. The first three notes of every major scale are called fa, sol, la, and so are the second three notes. The remaining note is called mi. In the American colonies, and later the U.S., it was called fa, sol, la, or sometimes, from the special notation they're used, patent notes or buckwheat notes. So that gives you an idea that someone had this idea at this point in our history. And it may go beyond that, but that's as far back as I've taken it. In the 1600s, you know, we settled America. Now, when America was settled, it was hard enough to get here with your neck on straight, much less your musical instruments and your hymnals from your church and this sort of thing. So people packed their Bibles and they packed their psalm books, which were the small books that have the words to the psalms and many other religious poetry, which they put their own songs to. Now they had to memorize these melodies because there was no musical notation written. I have a couple of psalm books here, or three or four. These are some very old psalm books that I brought with us tonight. And you see, there's no music. But this was small enough that it could be thrown in the shirt pocket or in the duffel bag or whatever they came here with. And this was very special to them. But they had to bring the memory of the music in their minds. Now, this presented a lot of problems. We must remember that the people who settled this country came to a wild area, but they weren't wild themselves. They came bringing with them the desire for religious freedom and religious celebration, but they had no means of published music or music teachers or music schools at that point. The children grew up without formal education, and of course that meant without formal music training. And by the early 1700s, the singing quality in New England, where the country started, had very seriously deteriorated. In fact, there's been a lot of quotes that I found in my research with people saying, oh, it sounds so horrible to hear these settlers groaning away into the night, trying to remember these tunes and getting them wrong and making them up. Some of the more formally trained people really had a lot of problem with that. If you want to hear some groaning, just come on to the classes this week because we're going to groan a lot. But so the American colonists using the psalm books presented some problems. They did not have their music publication houses here yet. They were all in England, and that was quite a day's ride to get back to England. So what happened was in the 1720s, a wonderful thing happened. In my opinion, a wonderful thing. Singing schools started springing up throughout the colonies. They were advocated by the Reverends Thomas Symes, John Tufts, and Thomas Walter. Now, these fellows had a great idea. They said, we're going to go into communities, and we're going to tell them to throw away those psalm books and learn music. We're going to teach them music. And this is what they set out to do. And this was greatly aided by the first book being published of a complete American composer. He composed every song in there, or he collected it from American composers, William Billings, better known as Old Bill Billings. And he wrote the first American book for singing schools, and it was called The New England Psalm Singer. Now, this worked out real well. The singing schools became very popular. They were established as a social institution right from the very beginning. It was great fun to go to a singing school to learn how to sing and also get to meet other people and sing and have some social time, because on the frontier there wasn't a lot of time for that, okay? At first, the demand for new tunes at these singing schools kept these composers really busy pumping out new tunes, and there was like an American revolution of music going on. It just really was the first blossoming of American folk music. And many times, these singing school composers really didn't know exactly what they were doing, so they stole a few themes from classical music. Beethoven, Bach, Haydn, you've all heard of those fellas. They would take melodies that they had heard and rewrite them, put words with it, and voila, they had a new book that they could sell. So the New England Psalm Singer was the first American book of singing school music. By the 1790s, there was a flood of books, and there was a flood of singing schools. Now, the frontier people thought it was wonderful. As I said before, that was just the best thing that had happened to them. But there were those of the genteel tradition, which I'm definitely not of, who had their own opinions. And I want to read to you a small excerpt here from an article written by a Miss Augusta Brown in 1848. And this article appeared in the Musician and Intelligencer of Cincinnati. The most mortifying feature and grand cause of the low estate of scientific music among us is the presence of common Yankee singing schools, so-called. We, of course, can have no allusion to the educated professors in vocal music from New England, but to genuine Yankee singing masters who profess to make an accomplished amateur in 1 month and a regular professor of music not in 7 years but in 1/4 of a year, and at the expense to the initiated person usually of $1. Hundreds of country idlers, too lazy or too stupid for farmers or mechanics, go to singing school for a spell to get diplomas from others scarcely better qualified than themselves. And then with their brethren, the far-famed Yankee peddlers itinerate to all parts of the land to corrupt the taste and pervert the judgment of the unfortunate people who, for want of better, have to put up with them. Now, that's of my tradition that I'm from, right there, she was talking about. I come down from 5 generations of singing school masters, and I'm carrying it on to corrupt and pervert your tastes. I make no apologies. Here is an ad that was in the Pennsylvania Gazette in 1760, I thought you might enjoy. Notice is hereby given that the singing school, lately kept in the rooms over Mr. Williams' school in 2nd Street, will again be open Monday evening, the 3rd of November next, at the same place, where the art of psalmody will be taught as usual in the best manner on Monday and Friday evenings from 6 to 8. And that if any number of ladies and gentlemen inclined to make up an exclusive set to sing on 2 other nights, they may be gratified by making application in time. So that was an ad for singing school. It actually was very prevalent, and those of genteel scientific music backgrounds really frowned on them. Okay, now, in 1801, a curious thing happened. Brought on by the singing schools, there were all kinds of new methods being thought of. Let's teach it this way, or let's teach music this way. It was an open field, open to any idea someone had. In, 1801, the first shape notebook was published using a system of 4 shapes. The fellows' names were William Smith and William Little. And they had this great idea of assigning shapes to the notes on the staff and assigning syllables. Fa, sol, la, fa, sol, la, mi, fa. That's the scale. They used the fa, sol, la, which came out of the Lancashire system from the 1600s. This was a big step in the direction of the singing schools all becoming shape note schools. they transferred from teaching music to teaching shape notes because it was the new thing, like the new dance, the new whatever, the new style. This was the new style of music. These fellas wrote this book, and they had 3,000 subscriptions for it before it was ever published. Before they even had it finished written, they had 3,000 people signed up and sent in their money. This was a booming business, too, I might also add to you, which you'll find out as we go along. So William Smith and Little had a wonderful idea. Now, also about the same time, but a little bit later, Timothy Swan had an idea, too, and he wrote the book New England Harmony, and it was in shape notes also. But it came a little after these people's books, so we credit them with having the first shape notebook. The next couple of years, everyone was writing their own system. The musical primer was written by Andrew Law, and it had four shapes also, but he had another idea. He said, hey, I'm going to take it one step further. I'm going to write it without the staff. Pretend that this chart has a superimposed staff to show you where it would be normally. But he wrote it without the lines, and you just had to guess if it was a high fa or a low fa. I have a Xerox here of what some of his music would look like. He said that this was his own invention, and it would not confuse the novice singing school master. Look at that. No lines and spaces. That would confuse me, and I am a singing school master, so I don't, well, try to be. I don't think that that one lasted very long. We don't hear much else from Andrew Law. So he claimed a lot of things in all the books that say Andrew Law claimed, but then there's always a disclaimer saying he didn't really do that. Poor old Andrew, somebody will take up his cause one day. Okay, now, there's also a definition of Oxford's Book of Music about buckwheat or patent notes, which is the other two terms that we use for shape note singing, and this is their definition. An American adaption of the staff notation for sight singing purposes on lines of Lancashire sol fa, but with a music type which is differently shaped heads, you see the shapes, for the notes, bearing the four names in use, fa, sol, la, mi. It dates from the late 18th century and still in use in the Bible Belt, or fundamentalist region of the southern U.S. Well, I'm from Western North Carolina, but I don't like that term too well. It's also done out west a lot, and it's as far west as Texas, and it's still done up north too, so let's not call it that. But that's, what do they know? They're in England, okay? All right, I'll write them, I'll take care of it, I promise. Now, I probably will too. James P. Carroll was an author of one of the books that we'll come to later, but he had this to say in his introduction. He said, they are so-called patent notes on account of their authors having obtained a patent on their invention. So we're talking about scientific history being made here on the lines of the space shuttle, I'm sure. Let me go on down the list here. We may need to change. Yeah. In 1813, a curious thing started happening. This gentleman, John Wythe, wrote a shape notebook. These are all shape notebooks that have been written. This gentleman wrote a shape notebook that became very important at camp meetings. Does anyone not know what a camp meeting is? That's where you pitch tents and everybody gets together and sings and prays, and you can't, it's sort of like a fiddler's convention, but you do religious things, okay? They used to do it a lot. They don't do them much anymore, but they still are some. But those became very popular because of the circuit riding preachers who would come into areas, be there a week, and hold a revival. So this particular book was written with that in mind. See, we're getting very commercial here. They start writing books to meet certain needs. Now, I must back up here. In 1805, a book called The Christian Harmony was written by Jeremiah Ingalls. It is not the Christian Harmony that we're going to sing out of this week. This fellow used the title first, and it was in conventional notation. This was of the scientific school, the genteel tradition, and he was trying to make a hard stab at converting people back to normal civilized music. It didn't make that quite a big of an impression. As you see, shape notes kept going. In 1850, the concentration of shape note singing moved west and moved south. The reason being is that's the way the frontier spread. And as new developments came into an area, of course, music teachers came, organs, churches with hymnals, the whole nine yards, and shape note singing quickly became outdated in the more developed areas, urban areas. As the frontier moved, our shape note singing teachers and their books moved along with it. That was their market, was the frontier, so they went there. That's why I'm up here in West Virginia today. I have to follow the market. That's where it is today. Okay, here you see more books being written, and if you'll notice, these books start being published in the South. The first Southern publisher of a shape notebook was Ananias, that's hard to say, Davison. And he published the Kentucky Harmony, which is a very important book in shape note history. Still, we're still using four shapes, okay? Now let's jot this back here. Here we have more books being brought up. This last edition of the Kentucky Harmony was in 1826, and he wrote the first edition in 1816. So you see these books kept being re-edited and revised and reprinted because they were sold out, and then the teacher would move into a new area and need more books to go sell. Now, as we come on down, you'll see this was very interesting. Anyone ever heard of Lowell Mason? Lowell Mason was a contemporary hymn writer in this period of time, and he and his brother got together a singing school book. They knew how to follow, you know, trends, but they wanted it in conventional music, round notes, because that's the way they were educated. And they were very much insulted when they took their book, The Ohio Sacred Harp, and the publishers changed it to shape notes because it would sell better in the South and the West. And that actually happened, and they were real mad at that publisher, and there's a whole story about what happened there. We have more books coming out. You see, the last edition of The Easy Instructor was in 1831. That's the first shape note book. It went all the way to 1831 from 1801. 30 years that book was reissued. That's a long time for back then. Now, in 1832, a curious thing happened. Someone came up with the idea, and there's a lot of controversy as to whom it was. Let's have seven shapes instead of four. There are four notes. Let's give each one of them a shape, because this is confusing. That one is in there twice, and that one's in there twice. Let's use seven shapes, and we'll give them all different names. Well, sometimes new ideas don't catch on. So it started in 1832, but you notice no one wrote books in it. These are still in four shapes. The old Die Hard, they were not going to change over to that. And in fact, this is a very important book in the shape note history, The Southern Harmony, written by William Walker. Now, William Walker was better known as Singin' Billy out of Spartanburg, South Carolina. He knew a good thing when he saw it. He says, I'm going to start doing this. I'm going to write me a book, and I'm going to hit the road. And he got his brother-in-law, B.F. White, who he married Miss Thurza Golightly, and B.F. White married Thurza's sister. Somehow this works. But they were brother-in-laws, and they collaborated on this book. And he says, we're going to do this. Well, old William Walker gets this idea. I never did like him anyway. I'm going to print it myself. And he flies off to Philadelphia and prints the book and leaves B.F. White out of it. It became the fastest selling shape note book in the country. You see, B.F. White didn't take him long. He wrote his own book. And he wrote his own book in the four shapes. It's called The Sacred Harp, and it's still being sung out of very widely today. In fact, these two books, The Sacred Harp and The Southern Harmony, are two of the most prevalent books written in shape note singing. But you see, after this four shapes, we see seven shapes starting to happen. The Valley Harmonist and the Union Harmony started coming along in seven shapes. These were a new invention. It didn't catch on very quickly, but they were the first ones. All right. Let's see. I want to read to you very briefly here what William Walker said about the four shapes. William Walker, in the introduction to the Southern Harmony, devoted a page discussing the different plans of notation. He says, there are seven plans of notation used in various parts of the world. Some even employ numerals, as in Germany. And in some parts of the United States, we use what's called the Italian Do-Re-Mi system. Some contend that no one can learn to sing correctly without using seven syllables. Although I have no objections to the seven-syllable plan, I differ a little with such an opinion, for I've taught the four-syllable patent notes, the Italian seven syllables, and the numerals also, and in 25 years' experience have always found my patent note pupils to learn as fast and sing as correctly as any. Now remember that, because he's going to eat those words in about 10 years. Okay, this was the first book here that really hit the charts in seven shapes. The Christian Minstrel by Jesse Aiken, he developed this system of seven shapes. These are the shapes that he used, and his book took off like lightning. In fact, the seven shapes that he developed are the shapes used today in gospel music. and all over the country. These shapes are not used in all of the seven shape books. As you'll find out, everybody has their own system. But these are the seven that survived history and are used throughout the country in the gospel music. Okay, you see, William also had another book in 1846, The Southern and Western Pocket Harmonist. I didn't hear much about that one. I don't think that was such a hot seller. Okay. See, we have four shapes still, but seven shapes also. Four, seven. They keep, there's a whole influx of books coming out now. No one can make up their mind which is the best. It's a very booming, competitive business. It was a business. And these singing schoolmasters would go from community to community hoping to sell their book. It was the best. It had the most newest scientific developments around. So that was the way they advertised them. The Hesperian Harp was said to be the best Southern book ever printed. It was by Reverend William Hauser, M.D. Okay, this one gained popularity, the Union Harmony, because it was used at camp meetings, and they were gaining big popularity by this time of year. This one is my favorite. The Harmonia Sacra, written by Joseph Funk, was originally the compilation of genuine church music in four shapes. But he's no fool. He saw seven shapes were happening, so he changed it to the Harmonia Sacra and changed it to seven shapes. It's the very same book, just redone. Yes?
Now, every time one of these books is coming out, it's not all new music, right?
They're stealing from each other. Yeah. Plagiarism was the rage. They stole, like I said, they stole from Beethoven, Handel, and each other. Anybody they could steal from. But this was the exact same book, just redone. In Western North Carolina, this was affectionately known as the Hominy Soaker. Harmonia Sacra. They started using the most Italian Latin names they could come up with to make it sound like it was the highbrowest music that you could learn. You know, that was in the Harmonia Sacra was it. Manual Sacred Music. The last edition of Southern Harmony was in 1854. It wasn't reprinted, but it is still in big use in the South. Big use. Social Harp, I have a copy of it here. I have copies of several of these books over here, which I'll let you look at in just a little bit. Last edition of the Harp of Columbia, that had been out about 50 years. Now, 1850 question mark. I have not been able to pin this date down to one date yet. Something important happened. Ira D. Sankey hooked up with Dwight Moore. Now, Dwight Moore was one of them evangelists that went all over the place and held camp meetings at YMCAs. Dwight Moody. Yes, you're right. Excuse me. Dwight Moody. And Ira provided the music. And they had a real team going and were very popular in the South and the West. Ira put out this book called Gospel Hymns. It was a shape note book. All of a sudden, this book caught on, and everybody else was writing books and calling them gospel. That is where the word gospel music originated, and here are some gospel books. Okay? They are more emotionally oriented in their text, if you understand what I'm saying. They have a different method of refrain and response. The choruses are, let's all go to heaven, fighting our ways, you know, onward Christian soldier kind of thing, where it's just a different feeling. These other shape notebooks were singing school text, which they were more reserved in most cases, and they had a little bit lower key in the music. Okay, so the gospel music really started taking off. And if you'll skip down here, you'll see that in 1887, the first gospel music publishing house opened up in Georgia, the A.J. Showalter Publishing House. And that's a very prominent name in gospel music today. Now, to skip back, we'll see that Christian Harmony came in 1866 by William Walker. Not only did he steal the Southern Harmony from his brother-in-law, B.F. White, he stole the name Christian Harmony from John Ingalls back in the 1700s. He is the patron saint of my area, but he had his flaws. I would like to do a little more research on him. In fact, my dad tells a funny story about the singing that he attends when he was a kid, and everybody thought he was just wonderful, and they decided that they were going to, I could just see this written up in a novel. They were all going to go to William Walker's grave and sing over it. He's buried in Spartanburg somewhere. I think near Converse College, I'm not sure. But they all go, and this one guy who is absolutely the biggest fan of William Walker in the world has this big, huge picture that he carries around all the time to the singings. So he's in the lead carrying this picture of William Walker, and they walk to the cemetery, and they couldn't find his grave. anywhere. They had their books, and Daddy said it was so hilarious. They were just following around. Finally, they found it. It was grown over in thorns and briars, and Daddy said it was really sad, you know. And so they sang over his grave, and then all of a sudden the college and some of the area people down there says, oh, he must have been somebody. We'll make a little monument around it. Now there's a little fence around it, and it has a little plaque and stuff. So the singing over the grave led to that, but I just see that as kind of funny that maybe some people really knew what old Billy was up to sometimes. But anyway, he did write a lovely book, The Christian Harmony. Now, I have to read to you what he said about the Christian Harmony. You remember what he said a while ago about four shapes? This is what he said later. Would any parent having seven children ever think of calling them by only four names? So, he issued one out in seven shapes, and he had his own system, of course. Right here, that's his shapes. Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, si, do. C and T are used interchangeably, by the way. If you see one or the other, it means the same thing. But he had his own shapes, put out his book, The Christian Harmony, took off with it, and sold many, many copies, and taught many classes out of The Christian Harmony. I have some copies here now. The earliest edition was 1866. I don't have a copy of that yet. I am looking. Here is a copy. This was a wedding present to me from my father. This is 1873 edition. And we can look at this one, but not open it. It's very, very fragile. But you see, this is an 1873 edition. It came out again in 1901. This was the vogue of the day. Christian Harmony. I just love that. Like, looks like some of the Spielberg movie captions, you know. Da 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 da. Everyone needs a copy. And this is 1901. And you see, this one's very fragile, too. In the beginning of all these books, it has rudiments of music. They teach out of these singing masters teach out of it. And they sell these books to other singing masters so they can read this and teach. So this lady was right that I read a while ago. People just taught themselves and went out and hit the road. I taught myself. I didn't study this anywhere. I mean, I learned from my family, so that's how it was done. It's called folk music. And this is a very fragile book, and I mentioned last night, if you were at the orientation last night, my dad has his name written on it. On every shape note book that my dad has, it has Quace Matters, either written in green pen, or he has pink fingernail polish across the corner. And that's because these are tools to him. And when he goes to singings, he passes these out. But by gosh, he expects to get them back. And you just don't walk out with a book with pink fingernail polish and expect to be inconspicuous. So he'll nail you, and I've seen him do that. Oh, my book. You're going out with my book. So that's my dad's. This is the book that my dad uses. And like I said, he relinquished it for this week for me to bring it up here. This is another story. This is the Christian Harmony that was redone in 1958. Now, these guys had a great idea. They said, you know, old William Walker sold a bunch of these books, and we're going to go down south, and we're going to teach some shape note classes, and by gosh, let's take that book, and let's redo it. And I tell you what, there's some songs in here that I just don't like. Let's leave them out, and my brother-in-law has written some Cracker Jacks of a song. Let's put them in. And that way he'll make a little money on it too, and we'll all, it'll be great. And that's what they did. It says, Revised 1958 by John Deason and O.A. Paris. And instead of William Walker's respectable picture, it has their picture in the front. By gosh, if I'd revised the book and done that much work, I'd have mine in there too. I don't knock them for it. But they did do a lot of damage, so to speak, to the old original book, because so many of the songs in here are gospel songs that are in the gospel tradition like you find here and are not the Christian harmony style songs. So it got our singings all mixed up. For the longest time, we'd be at a singing, we'll say, okay, page 11 in this book and page 52 in the brown book. Oh, it's not in the brown book. Remember, that's one they left out. All right, pass the black book around. And it got to be a real headache. So after one of those singings one afternoon, at Morningstar Methodist Church, myself and my husband and my father and two other singers were sitting behind the church pews after it was over with and behind the choir loft. And I said, you know, this was a bummer today. It just got so mixed up. And I feel so sorry for these old guys who have these old books and want to sing out of them. And all these young people like myself have this black book. And we're getting up there calling songs that they don't sing. So there really needs to be some standardization. Well, a gentleman was there by the name of George Reynolds, who is with the Foxfire program. And George Reynolds says, doggone it, it is a shame. And he'd done a lot of research on this, done a lot of recording, and he says, I'm going to see that something's done about it. So he and several other people got together and had the old book, the original book, reprinted in its entirety, exactly as it was. The only addition is a lovely preface in here that tells the story of Christian Harmony music and how it's come about. So it's a lovely preface that was updated, introduction, written by Daniel Patterson. No, Brent Howard Holcomb. Daniel Patterson writes the one in Straight Note, Sacred Heart. But here's William Walker, right there. We put his picture in there. Okay, so that's where we stand now. This came out in 1979.
Liz, George was up here a couple of years ago, and at that point he said that they were out of those. Have they been reissued at all?
Well, it's a long story. I think a small reissue was done. I have 15 of the last 40, and the others are in his little hands. And if I need them, I can get them from George, but he doesn't just hand them out. And I mean to tell
you,
well, what I was going to say is that these that I have with me, I will sell, but you have to wait till the end of the week to take it because we have to have them for the class. So George and I are talking right now about getting it reissued. It's a lot of money and a lot of effort. I don't know. I hope it does. I mean, my gosh, what am I going to use when I go to Alabama and set up singing school, you know? Okay, I want to step back to the Sacred Harp for a minute and tell you how many times it has been reissued. It was done first time in 1844. Now, it is a four-note system, 1844, 1850, 1859, 1869, 1911, 1936, 1949, 1960, 1965. That book has been redone that many times. The Social Harp is another lovely four-shaped book, and I have a facsimile edition of it. See, a lot of these old books are being redone like this now. People are finally getting interested in it. And this copy was redone in 1973, so I have that with me too. And I have the New Harp of Columbia, which is done in Tennessee a lot, right here. So I have several of all the books that you can look at in just a minute. All right, I told you about that, I told you about that. I wanted to show you that the New Harp of Columbia out of Tennessee has its own shape. It has an hourglass shape for dough. And, whoops, this fella here who wrote this article, his name is Junius Allison, wrote an article for the North Carolina Folklore Journal, and it's a good article. He collected this many systems from all the books that he's looked at, 1 to 7 systems. Everybody had their own. That was the way they marketed their book. I have a better system because my dough looks like this, and you'll remember it. Whatever. So the systems get kind of confusing. We are going to use William Walker's system this week, since that is the book I have, which would make sense. Oh, great. In fact, I'm going to pass these around. That's a good idea. Grab one and pass. These are the handouts that we're going to use in the class. Yes. What's your question?
Just a quick question. Uh-huh.
Okay, Christian Harmony was described in William Walker's advertisement as being music more suitable for church services, more refined, and he used another word, more sedate. Gospel music is more emotion-backed, has the refrains, we'll all shout in heaven and all this kind of stuff. Christian Harmony does have those kinds of refrains, but the tempo is slower, the harmonies are different, and it is a different style of music. It is an earlier style than gospel. Gospel is a later style. So that's a good question.
Has Shake-It-Up singing has always been associated with religious?
Yes. In some of the singing school texts, they did have some other music just to teach the lesson.
In studying church music, they classify the church-type song as hymns, and these gospel songs were the swinging upbeat songs.
Right, right.
And the others were the sedate hymns.
You can almost dance to a gospel song.
Right, okay.
It has a different beat. Okay, now I've told you what I know about what I've researched here. I brought you up to date here. You'll see these are the last editions, 65 Sacred Harp, Social Harp, New Harp of Columbia, Christian Harmony. These are the latest books. Christian Harmony, 1979. It's the latest shape notebook to be redone that I know of. There may be another one, but I don't know of it yet. Okay, now briefly, I want to tell you what this all means to me. I told you the history, and anybody could have told you what I just told you. No problem, just do a little research. I'm going to speed this up a little bit. I first started going to shape note singings when I was 5 months old. My dad has been a singing master ever since I was born, but even before then. And our favorite singing is in my church every September, Morning Star Methodist Church, the second Sunday in September. It's been going on for 97 years. This year will be the 98th. Is that right, Lynn? 98? 98 years we have done this singing out of the Christian Harmony book, the second Sunday in September, in the choir loft at this church. Before it was done in the choir loft of this church, it was done in the choir loft of the Locust Field Church, and it got torn down, so the singers had to move. And that's where they ended up. It happened to be in Morning Star Methodist Church. The occasion is called Old Folks Day, and it's akin to homecomings that most people have in their churches, where we have dinner on the ground. That doesn't mean on the ground. I never have understood that. We have tables.
On the grounds.
On the grounds, but we say dinner on the ground. Yeah. Thank you for clarifying that. But we have dinner on the ground.
Outside instead of inside.
Exactly, out on table, picnic, potluck picnic. We have church service in the morning, and we have dinner on the grounds, and then we have a singing in the afternoon. Some of my earliest memories of life go back to these singings. I can remember hearing these sounds, listening to them as a child, not knowing what they were yet. I can remember getting antsy during church, thinking of all that food that was out there. The week before September 2nd Sunday is the most hectic week in my family. It even rivals Christmas, it rivals Thanksgiving. My mother could cook, and you all could bring every relative in your area, and my mother would have enough food for all of you. It's her big day as well as it's the singer's big day. So it's a big family fellowship that we all enjoy, and people come from all over the United States. There's another singing in a community not far from us called Etowah. It is done two times a year, the first Sunday and the second Sunday in May. And it's very similar, except we used to be in a church there. I say we, I wasn't there. But we, meaning us singers, used to be in a church there. We got kicked out of there when they got hymnals and organs. They moved us into an elementary school auditorium. We got kicked out of there when they tore down the auditorium and made it into a library. And now we're in that elementary school cafeteria. So we'll sing anywhere. It doesn't matter. We're not dying. We're going to sing. And in fact, there's been some occasions at Old Folks Day at Morning Star Methodist Church where one year they had gospel music come in and sing along with Christian Harmony. It doesn't mix. It's a different style of music. It doesn't mix. Old Folks Day is for Christian Harmony, and I will fight for that to my dying breath, because that's something very important to me, and that's something that happened, and now people realize that it's just not something that can be intermingled with something. It's its own style, and we're fighting really hard to keep it alive. It's not died yet, and it won't die, but that's what I want to tell you about Old Folks Day. Any one of you, be welcome to come sing. The atmosphere of a singing, there's an unwritten code at these singings, sort of akin to a pecking order. You don't go in and pick up a book and say, all right, let's all sing number 82. And you don't sit there and talk while someone's up there singing or picking out their number. And if you're a young person, you don't go sit up on the front row and sit there and think that you're in charge and you're on the front row and everybody sees you. It's an unwritten code. It's never been verbally told to me, but I grew up knowing it. When Lynn and I got married and Lynn came to the singings, Lynn figured it out. There's no problem to figure it out. It's not that you're made to feel unwelcome. It's just that there definitely is a hierarchy. And it's one of the things I enjoy most about it. It has nothing to do with how old you are necessarily, or if you're male or female. It has to do with how long you've been singing. if you can get up and lead a song, if you know it well enough that the whole crowd isn't going to get lost just because, you know, you're not a strong enough leader. My dad chooses the leaders. He'll let anybody lead one time. But if he finds out they can't lead very well, then he'll help them out so they'll do better next time. But it's the kind of thing where there's respected leaders and you sit in your seat in anticipation, oh goody, it's Richard Moss's turn. He always leads this one. Or dadgum, I know he'll lead that one and I haven't gotten my part yet on that. So that's one of the things that I enjoy most about it. There's a feeling of community. Everybody knows everybody. It's the same people every year. It's the same old guys telling the same jokes every year. And you laugh at the same jokes every year because you know what the punchlines are going to be. And it's everybody, a fellowship, it's a real community. I first learned how to sing when I was 7, I think. It varies as my memory goes. But I was out of singing and I was outside playing in the sandbox with my sisters, because it was no fun to go to this because it was all old people and the old guys always had snuff in their mouths and wanted to kiss you. And the little old lady smelled like roses and mothballs, if you know what I mean. It's true, it just was not a fun thing to do when you're 7 years old. It was really a drag. But I always went because my dad took us to Etowah Elementary School and they had this huge slide as big as this room, and my sisters and I could go out and slide and play in the sandbox and eat this food that my mother would send. My mother wouldn't go to this one, she'd just send food. And my dad would go in and sing, and we'd have fun playing on the playground. One day, it started lightning and storming outside. I thought, well, I better not be out here much longer, it's getting rainy. And I went to the edge of the hall, and it was pitch dark in there. Evidently, lightning had struck the light and knocked it out, it was pitch dark. And they started singing this song called Dark and Thorny is the Desert. As dark and thorny is the desert through which pilgrims make their way. And it goes on about fiends, loud howling, and Satan's wrath. And I'm standing there thinking, I can stay out here in this storm or I can go in there. And I thought about it a long time. I'm serious. And I saw my Uncle Vaughn, who is my most favorite relative to this day. He's dead now, but he's my favorite in all my memory. And I says, I'm going to go down there and sit next to Uncle Vaughn, and by golly, those fiends ain't going to get me. And I go tearing down that aisle and sit next to him. Well, the power had been knocked out, and they were like just barely able to read. The old guys didn't need the books anyway. They knew them by heart. So I'm sitting there, and I says, well, I might as well just do what he's doing. And he started pointing out on the book. He sang the tenor line, which is this top line. And he started pointing what he was doing, and I started following along. I said, well, this is neat. I took piano lessons, so I sort of knew what he was talking about. And before you know it, I was singing, and my dad was so proud of me. And when we got home, he talked to my mother. He said, oh, Liz came down and sang, and it was so wonderful, and I got a lot of attention over this. I said, well, I'm going to do this again. That wasn't hard. You know, I got strokes. So that's basically how I got started. It's funny, though. About 5 years ago, I discovered I don't sing tenor. I'm an alto. But there was never any relatives that sang alto except my grandmother, and she was already dead, so I hadn't learned from her. So now I sing alto, which it happened because I'd learned to sing better, I guess. My daddy learned at singing schools, just like I was telling you about. My daddy's 73. And he learned at singing schools, and his mother did, and his father, and all of the people in his family did. He also learned from a man named Asbury Smathers, and he'd walk up to his house in the evenings. It was the time when you just didn't run to town when you had nothing to do, because you had to walk. And so he'd go up to Asbury's and sing. Rather than loafer, he'd go sing with Asbury. And he also learned from my grandmother, and my favorite story about my grandmother is that my dad woke up one night, and he heard someone singing the song Angel Band. And he heard this high tenor voice, oh, come angel band, come and around me stand. And it was my grandmother singing in her sleep. Then he heard her go and sing the notes, and he heard her sing the whole song in her sleep. And to this day, we always sing angel band at the singings, and my dad has a tear or two because he remembers that. That's one of his special memories. And I didn't get to know her because she was dead before I was born, and it's a special memory I have that he shared with me. There are legends in these singings. Lyman Clark, Leonard Westmoreland, Richard Moss, several legends that some of them I had the extreme good fortune to know and some that I didn't, but I just have to hear the stories. And sometimes I'm so frustrated because I go to these singings and I've seen these old guys, these old ladies, and I remember what they look like and I try to describe it to my dad. I say, well, she always wore this little pillbox hat, you know, and she had a cane. Who was she? And he can't remember. Or he'll say, well, I think it was so-and-so and so-and-so. And they're dead now, and I have these memories that I can't connect. I can't be sure that he's thinking of the same people I am. But he does have some rare footage of some of the earlier singings on home films, which I'm right now in the process of getting converted to slides. So maybe I'll get the good fortune to show you those one day and let you see these old people that I'm talking about that I did meet and he took films of. There was a time when this music was dying out, the old ones were dying, and the churches got more modern, and we got kicked by the wayside. We weren't important anymore. But thanks to things like Augusta, Warren Wilson College, Mars Hill College, there's several colleges and universities that are taking this upon themselves to have regular singings. People like Dr. Edith Card, who wrote the foreword about shape note singing, she's a personal friend of my family's, in the Foxfire 7. She's done extensive work. Her doctoral dissertation was on the ornamentation of shape note singing. On just the ornamentation, she did a dissertation. It's virgin territory for musicologists. It really is. I want to show you some pictures in here, and then we're going to do a little bit of singing ourselves here real quick. Here's my dad sitting out in his lawn chair under the tree. This tells the story of him. It's sort of like an interview. And here's my Uncle Bruz, who was 101 when he died. And he sang all the way to that time. Well, he's 102 when he died. This day was his birthday, and I was there when they took the picture. I took the Foxfire people up there. And they also took this picture of him, which is on the tape cover of the Foxfire tape. And they thought it was such a nifty picture that they used it on the cover of the magazine for this winter. And I had this picture framed in my house. He sang tenor, and one day I was sitting next to him, and he says, honey, I said, Uncle Bruce, how do you sing so high? He goes, honey, I could sing it high enough if the note was above that man's name, I could reach it. And he could, too. I'm serious about that. So there's a lot of legends here. These books and materials are very special to me. This Foxfire magazine has an article in here about my dad and about myself. I have to have a disclaimer on this interview with me. When you read this interview, you're going to think this is an old woman, 90 years old, rambling on. When they interviewed me, I was in the middle of something at my office. Evan was in the room. The phone rang, so I kept getting interrupted, and I wander and ramble like I'm 100 years old. So please keep that in mind.